The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Private Equity Players Go All In to Scoop Up Private Physician Practices, prompting concerns that care may take a backseat to return on investment. Will cash eclipse care? And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, Private Equity Enters Healthcare Scene. Private equity players go all in to scoop up private physician practices, prompting concerns that care may take a backseat to return on investment. And this is written by Zach Izzo. As a student in medical school, Dr. Garrett Franklin didn't have much exposure to independent practice. The training instead was focused on hospitals and other larger groups. But after completing his time at East Carolina University's Brody School of Medicine, Franklin landed a position with Raleigh Medical Group, a large independent practice in the Triangle, which was looking to move into orthopedics. Franklin practices in both family and sports medicine. Joining the practice was a bit of a risk, as Franklin was fresh out of school with a few hundred thousand dollars in student loan debt, but for Franklin, the risk was worth it. I joined this practice because of the flexibility, Franklin says. You have a say in what goes on day to day, and I could craft how many patients I see. Also, on the business side, I can get involved with contract negotiations. But the number of physicians in Franklin's position has shrunk as hospitals and larger health systems acquire independent practices. Hospitals have invested in acquiring primary care practices with the idea that controlling general practitioners will enable the health system to better control referral sources for the specialists they employ. Between 2012 and 2020, the share of physicians who work at practices they wholly own dropped from about 60% to 49%, according to data from the American Medical Association. During that same time, the share of physicians working in practices with some hospital ownership or as direct hospital employees rose from about 29% to nearly 40%. But over the last few years, an alternative has begun to emerge and take hold. Private equity firms have accelerated the pace at which they are acquiring and rolling up physician practices with the pitch of offering a way for physicians to maintain a level of independence while shifting the weight of their administrative burdens. While private equity adds efficiency and productivity to the healthcare sector, the purpose of these investments is clear: to make money and grow the return on investments of businesses in healthcare that often collides with the needs of patients. And some observers believe that could lead to far more legal duels and eventual scrutiny from lawmakers in Washington, D.C. For now, however, the activity level among physician practice groups and other affiliated services using private equity as the financiers are growing larger. The trend is taking place throughout the country, including in the Triangle, where both national and regional organizations are growing their presences. The scale is that private equity investment is growing and there's very little oversight, very little transparency, so it's essentially a consolidating force on steroids, says Jane Zhu, a physician and researcher at Oregon Health and Science University. PE targets physician practices. Zhu graduated from medical school about 10 years ago, around the time private equity firms first started moving into primary care physician practices. At the time, Zhu says there was plenty of discussion among her colleagues about private equity firm purchasing practices, but not much evidence about what this means for both patients and physicians. So about 5 years ago, Zhu and other researchers began looking into ways to answer these questions, beginning with getting an idea of the scope of private equity's investment into physician practices. Through a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2020, Zhu and her colleagues identified 355 physician practices acquired by private equity firms between 2013 and 2016, with the number of deals increasing each year. These deals included 1,426 practice sites and 5,714 physicians. They consolidate across the market, across specialties, across multiple regions, Zhu says. They roll up and expand these practices, and then there's cost-cutting measures and revenue-generating measures. The pace of deals hasn't slowed down, especially as the COVID-19 pandemic exacerbated challenges independent physicians were already facing. Between January 2019 and January 2022, the number of corporate-owned physician practices, which includes those backed by private equity funds, rose from about 37,200 to 68,500, according to data from the Physicians Advocacy Institute, a nonprofit. During the same time, hospital-owned practices jumped from about 61,900 to 66,700. Larry Robbins, a partner at Weirich Robbins, Yates & Potten in Raleigh, says the firm has seen a steady number of these transactions over the last 4 or 5 years, with a slight uptick recently due to COVID. The firm has worked with both hospital systems and larger national private equity-backed organizations as they look to acquire practices. On the private equity side, these organizations are focused on putting together businesses, reducing overhead, and improving cash flow and profitability. For some firms, these are investments for a certain time frame, while others may be pulling together practices to build for the long term. Because the larger private equity-backed organizations are set up to be efficient, what it permits them to do as they aggregate those practices is eliminate individual back-office operations and put together either statewide or regional offices that would support practices throughout a particular geographic region, Robin says. These private equity deals involve a payment, usually up front, that considers hard assets and cash flows. As part of the deals, these larger national organizations could require physicians to roll over a portion of the purchase price and effectively invest in the aggregator entity that's combining the practices. This creates a sticky relationship in which physicians benefit to the extent that this organization continues to grow and acquire other practices, Robin says. Aside from the national brands with a presence in the Triangle, the area has seen interest from smaller organizations that have begun consolidating physician practices in recent years. These companies are positioning themselves as a way for physicians to continue practicing independently with a reduced administrative burden rather than being acquired by a hospital. Sverica Capital Management in 2017 acquired MedFirst, a regional provider based in Jacksonville that at the time included about 6 to 7 clinics. With the support of Sverica, the practice has since grown to more than 20 primary and urgent care clinics throughout North Carolina, with aims for further expansion. While the company has practiced in larger cities, such as Raleigh and Greensboro, many of its clinics are in more rural areas of the state with fewer health care options. This includes cities like Roxboro and Roanoke Rapids. The company, which has moved its corporate office to Raleigh, is acquiring physician groups with the purpose of sustaining the value of independent primary care providers in the state, says MedFirst CEO Paul Fennick. We can continue to help them take off their patients, take care of their patients without the burden of running a business in a volatile environment, Fennick says. Pressure on independent practices. Insurance providers are also investing in primary care, sometimes in tandem with investment firms. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina and Deerfield Management Company in late 2021 launched ALO, spelled A-L-O, a practice management resource. And a few days later, ALO announced its investment in Advanced Care, a primary care provider with more than 30 practices throughout North Carolina. The company helps physicians who join the Advance brand with payer contracting, billing, technology, and other services, while allowing physicians to maintain a high degree of autonomy inside their practices, says Matt Eirich, the CEO of both ALO and Avance. In addition to its Avance brand, ALO in February announced a clinically integrated network as a way of reaching additional practices throughout the state. The company aims to grow its network of practices by both folding in existing ones and standing up new practices that may employ physicians already working in a community, Eirich says. Most of the company's clinics are based around primary care, a focus that is due in part to the role primary care plays in the broader market. Shift to value-based care. Delivery system and healthcare has moved toward a value-based care model, Eirich says. Implicit in that is a strong and longitudinal primary care provider who is investing in delivering comprehensive care. This shift towards value-based care, which is a model that ties what providers can earn for their services to patient outcomes, is beneficial for patients, but it requires economies of scale for physician practices to benefit, Zhu says. Value-based care includes more data collection and reporting. There are trade-offs for everything, Zhu says. In theory, value-based payment is good, but what it means is health systems are more adept at getting value out of that payment system. Raleigh Medical Group has successfully competed in this consolidated marketplace because of its size. The group has three offices and about 30 physicians focused on primary, with numerous other physicians specializing in certain areas of medicine like dermatology and gastroenterology. The larger we grow, the more it helps us buoy against the hospital systems in these larger organizations, Franklin says. Despite the group's size, it still struggles to compete with hospitals in areas like staffing. Health systems, which are dealing with their own workforce shortages, are able to offer higher salaries to workers than smaller practices. Primary care, Franklin says, lives on the margins. This was a point emphasized during the pandemic when the numbers of patients visiting Raleigh Medical Group dropped. Some physicians took reduced salaries for a couple of months or didn't get paid at all. The medical group is also competing with health systems when it comes to attracting young physicians straight out of medical school to join the practice. Our practice is getting a bit older and doctors are retiring, Franklin says. We don't have a mechanism to recruit doctors where the hospital systems are really set up for that. Given these challenges, joining a group supported by private equity funding can be drawn for physicians interested in shifting the business side of a practice to a third party. The benefit for the practice, other than the immediate cash flow, which people have needed during COVID, is physicians want to focus on people, not filling out spreadsheets and forms, says Dr. Shauna Guthrie, president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. Guthrie holds roles in multiple areas of healthcare, including a part-time position as chief medical officer for Maria Parham Health in Henderson and as medical director at Granville Vance Public Health. Guthrie also runs a small primary care clinic in Henderson that operates on a membership-based model in which patients pay monthly fees and Guthrie sees them when needed. Through this approach, Guthrie gets around some of the administrative burdens that independent physicians typically deal with. She, for example, doesn't bill insurance, despite about half of her patients having insurance. These administrative burdens have only grown in recent years. For instance, North Carolina's transition from standard Medicaid to Medicaid managed care means there are more parties for physicians to work with. With these pressures, it's up to physicians to decide what's best for them and their communities when it comes to potentially selling their practice or merging it with a larger organization, Guthrie says. There's no model of primary care that's perfect, Guthrie says. If there was, we would all be doing that. Long-term implications. Over the last year, as CEO of Curry Advisory, Steve DiBiase has heard increased discussions among the company's clients about private equity investment. Curry Advisory is a business unit within the Raleigh-based physician services company Curry, which focuses on independent practices. DiBiase, who was previously the CEO of Emerge Ortho's practices in the Wilmington and Triad regions, says these conversations have not yet translated to increased deal closures over the last year. However, the firm works with numerous clients that have taken on private equity investment, either as an original platform acquisition or as an addition to a roll-up strategy. Typically, DiBiase says, these practices are in situations where they have their eyes on growth but are struggling to expand at the level they could with the support of private equity funding. While physicians may benefit from these sort of deals, the typical private equity cycle can present some long-term concerns. For instance, physicians must weigh what happens in 5 to 10 years if an original private equity investor sells their company to another buyer. It's hard to get an understanding of what the future will look like, DiBiase says. It gets difficult to unwind when private equity comes in. Private equity's interest in the broader healthcare industry is not new. Prior to moving into physician practices, private equity firms invested heavily in hospitals and health systems. Dr. Marcelo Cirillo, a physician and researcher at Duke University, is part of a research team that identified 42 private equity leverage buyouts involving 282 hospitals from 2003 through 2017. These deals took place across 38 states throughout the U.S. This didn't include any hospitals in North Carolina, however. In 2018, just outside the study's time frame, Apollo Global Management acquired LifePoint Health for about $5.6 billion. LifePoint operates multiple hospitals throughout North Carolina, including Wilson Medical Center. The hospitals the group identified in the study published in 2021 weren't strung out and failing financially. Instead, they were already in decent shape before the transaction, Cirillo says. Following the deals, costs went down, partly due to staffing ratio decreases, and operating margins improved. When it came to a central question about patient outcomes, there were no clear takeaways, Cirillo says. There were no major clinical changes to non-elective admissions before and after these deals, although the findings do raise a question about why there weren't more obvious increases in patient outcomes if that was the stated motive behind these deals. If you're looking for a reason to love private equity, you're probably not going to find it, Cerullo says. If you're looking for a reason to hate private equity in healthcare, you're probably not going to find it. When it comes to physician practices, the effects on patients remain unclear. However, Zhu and her colleagues identified a 20% increase per insurance claim in a more recent study tracking private equity deals involving certain specialties from 2016 to 2020. The researchers also identified a nearly 40% increase in new patients to these practices. This increase in costs is not something that's solely limited to private equity, but instead is a measure seen more broadly in healthcare consolidation, Zhu says. And this consolidation looks set to continue as companies like Amazon and CVS Health move deeper into primary care with their own respective billion-dollar deals. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, that's the reality, Zhu says. This is happening rapidly before our eyes. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Forecast sees busy summer. European travel may not feel like a dash to Disney World, at least not yet, but the old world is getting new interest as the pandemic years recede. Last month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told Congress that there was unprecedented demand for passports this year, with applications up 30 to 40% from a year ago. He said the number of passports issued could pass the record 22 million from 2022. According to Airlines for America, the number of checkpoints at TSA was just 0.6% below 2019 for the first 3 months of 2023. In March, international ticket sales were 3.8% over 2019 levels, while domestic travel was down 4.3%, according to Airlines for America. London's Heathrow Airport, which has a direct flight to Raleigh-Durham International Airport, saw March passenger traffic that was 48.4% above March 2022 and only 4% lower than 2019. Interestingly, Heathrow had 1.5 million passengers from North America in March 2023, more than the 1.47 million passengers from the region in March 2019. So if you're in love with the Louvre, expect longer lines if you want a glimpse of Mona Lisa's smile. Effort supports black restaurants in the Carolinas. Black Restaurant Week is back in the Carolinas for its third year. The campaign, which has a national presence, will be active across North and South Carolina through May 7. The goal is to boost support for local black-owned establishments and highlight places serving African-American, African, and Caribbean cuisine. Restaurants can join the program at no cost and receive free marketing materials, inclusion on a national directory, and training on small business grants. North Carolina has 32 food and beverage spots represented. Local participants include Pure Soul, Uncorked Raleigh, Blue Teaspoon, Golden Crust Caribbean Restaurant, and Bon Frite Haitian Food Truck. Black Restaurant Week was started in 2016 by Warren Luckett, Phelan Farrell, and Derek Robinson in Houston. COVID-19 changed the landscape since 2020. Now the price of food is soaring. From being overlooked for revitalization funds to inflation, most black-owned culinary businesses cannot afford advertisements, PR, marketing to build awareness and attract consumers. That's why we proudly do this for free. It's peer-to-peer support for 10 or 14 days within each market, Luckett says. Local development projects lauded. Congratulations to the winners from the 24th Annual Triangle Crew Champion Awards, held April 27 at the Embassy Suites in Cary. Winners included Fenton for Best Development Project, Raleigh Ironworks for Best Redevelopment Project, Pendo for Best Interiors Office Project, and Glasshouse Kitchen for Best Interiors Mixed Use Project. 321 Coffee in Durham won the Community Enhancement Award, while VinFast won for Economic Development. And 301 Hillsborough at Raleigh Crossing won the Green, Well, or Sustainability Award. Most Creative Marketing Campaign went to Spark for its campaign that included customized Nike shoes, a branded beer fridge, and a Taste of Raleigh cocktail kit. A special recognition award for outstanding public service was given to Note in the Pocket, a nonprofit making a meaningful and impactful investment in the community. Individuals were also recognized. Sharat Nagara of Salido.net was awarded for professional service. The Rising Leader in Commercial Real Estate Award was given to Tiffany Barrier of CBRE Raleigh. And the Impact Award was given to Adrian Cole of the Raleigh Chamber. Crew Excellence was awarded to two people, Tanya Mills of NAI Tri Properties and Carrie Saunders of Triangle Crew. Name change in Moore County. Moore County Partners in Progress is getting a new name that better describes its mission, as the organization will now be known as Moore County Economic Development Partnership. Natalie Hawkins, executive director of the organization, announced the change and a newly launched website as well. Moore County is attracting new residents and businesses drawn by the community's slower pace of life. Co-warehousing space added. A new warehousing company just signed on for 60,000 square feet of warehouse space in Raleigh to accommodate the company's growth. Blue Company, a co-warehousing space company started by Jason Wyden, the founder of Raleigh Founded, is leasing two buildings at 510 and 517 Pylon Drive in West Raleigh, just outside the Beltline. The industrial building at 510 Pylon Drive is 25,360 square feet, and the building at 517 is 34,063 square feet and is owned by Stout Ventures, an investment company in the Sun Belt. Blue Company is building a network of co-warehousing spaces for service-based companies, tradespeople, makers, and food and beverage entrepreneurs. The buildings are in the Pylon Commercial Park, which is next to the J.C. Ralston Arboretum. And finally, Durham Company adds to investment. Durham's Net Power has secured another $275 million in capital tied to its pending SPAC deal, a combination that could transform the startup into the region's next public company. The latest capital commitment is tied to the proposed SPAC combination between Net Power and Rice Acquisition Corporation II, which would take Net Power public. The company say Occidental Petroleum has increased its commitment to the PIPE, private investment in public equity, by another $250 million, bringing its ownership stake in the combined company to 39%. The Rice family has committed an additional $25 million to the PIPE, bringing its total investment to $125 million. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to some of the top stories. Highwood sees profit rise, seeks to build cash reserves. This is written by Kaylee Thompson. Highwood's Properties' first quarter results were more positive than expected, with the Raleigh company posting a year-over-year increase in profit while reporting a 5.9 times debt to adjusted EBITDA ratio. The firm reported a net income of $43.8 million for the first quarter, an increase from $40.3 million in the first quarter 2022, and its funds from operations beat analyst forecasts by 0.05 cents, coming in at 98 cents per share. But on an earnings call April 26, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer Brendan Moriana said, "I would say second and third quarters are below for what we're expecting. We do expect that operating margins will be lower in the remainder of the year. However, its debt to EBITDA ratio is increasing as it was 5.3 times this same time last year. The 5.9 times ratio combined with the two separate $200 million loans it has acquired in the last two quarters to pay down debt could indicate the company has too heavy of a debt load as it is increasing its debt more than its earnings. In early April, the company secured a $200 million five-year loan at a fixed rate of 5.69% and secured by Bank of America Tower at Legacy Union in Charlotte. Moriana said it will be used to pay down its line of credit. At the end of 2022, the company had $386 million drawn on its $750 million credit line. Moriana said it could also be used to potentially fund projects that are in its development pipeline. It is developing 1.6 million square feet of office properties in five markets, worth $518 million as of the end of the first quarter of 2023. Just 21.8% of that is pre-leased. One of those is in Glen Lake 3, part of the company's Glen Lake office park near Crabtree Valley Mall, which will have 205,000 square feet of Class A office space and 13,000 square feet of amenity retail space. While the building is fully financed, it is only 14.6% pre-leased. For Glen Lake 3, we've put a lot of proposals out and activity has increased in the last 90 days. We don't have any strong prospects, tenants at this time, President and CEO Ted Glink said on the earnings call. The decision making has been slow. We would love to have more activity in Raleigh on development. And our next article is written by Lauren Arnasorge, Wells Fargo leader to retire, successor named. Nearly 6 years after moving from Washington, D.C. to take on the market leader role for Wells Fargo and Raleigh, Mike Golden has announced his pending retirement. Golden's last day is May 5. He's being replaced by John Zimmerman, who currently oversees the Greater Philadelphia region for the bank. Golden, a North Carolina native, has been at Wells Fargo and its successor companies for 43 years, having started the February after his early graduation from UNC Greensboro. He has seen the industry change completely multiple times, and he has faith in his trajectory, despite recent headlines about bank failures tied to Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank of New York, he said. When I started in banking, there were not interstate banking laws, Golden says. A bank could not operate outside of its state. There's always been a change in our industry. It's been highly visible, but I would tell you there's always been some element of change. He says he's proud of being able to maintain Wells Fargo's long-held leadership position in the region, as well as how we have extended in the community support arena, he says. Golden says among his proudest accomplishments are the service he's performed as a board member at area nonprofits, from the North Carolina Symphony to the Interfaith Food Shuttle. While he's worked in 10 markets across the company and been on several boards along the way, there's something about holding a board seat during the pandemic that makes it particularly memorable, he says, calling it some of the most unique work that I've been involved with. Golden took the reins in 2017 following the departure of longtime local leader Jack Clayton. But unlike Clayton, who would go on to take a business strategy leadership role at Town Bank, Golden says he's really retiring. I've loved what I've done with this company and am very indebted for the wonderful career they've provided for me, Golden says. If I still wanted to work, I'd continue to work here. Golden plans to stay in the Triangle for now, at least when he's not exploring Pawleys Island, South Carolina, where his family has a beach house, and traveling with his wife. Golden has met with his successor multiple times. Even with some of the news headlines you hear across the country about pending gloom and recession, this is a vibrant, strong market, Golden says, he told Zimmerman. Chatham County to get fiber internet boost. This is written by Evan Hoopfer. Nearly 2,000 additional Chatham County homes and businesses will have high-speed fiber internet connections after grants from the state and county. During the recent Chatham County Board of Commissioners meeting, the board agreed to a $350,000 grant that will aid Charlotte's Brightspeed to lay the fiber for hundreds of homes and businesses in Chatham County. The North Carolina Department of Information Technology is also providing a $4 million grant. We do believe you're our best partner to get this done for people in an equitable way, so that Chatham County can really move into the 21st century in a way that serves significant parts of our community that did not see the possibility before, said Karen Howard, chair of the Chatham County Board of Commissioners, talking to a Brightspeed executive during an April 17 meeting. Fiber is the gold standard of high-speed internet because of its speed and reliability. The pandemic shined a spotlight on the necessity for high-speed internet throughout the country as remote work and remote learning became the norms. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal, and we start with Lauren Onisorge's page on startups and airlines. Duo efforts to solve global water crisis. Startups' plans include cost-effective way of treating wastewater. Could toilet water play a role in combating the global water crisis? That's part of the long-term vision of entrepreneur Sue Meacham, co-founder of NALA Membranes, a local startup looking to advance water purification technology. According to the nonprofit water.org, 771 million people lack access to safe water. Meacham's startup is trying to help solve the problem using wastewater. Over the past few years, NALA has grown from a five-person company operating out of First Flight Venture Center in Research Triangle Park to a 12-person operation with an 8,700-square-foot headquarters in Morrisville. NALA deals in complex, engineer-heavy science. Only recently has it reached the point where it's able to send samples out to potential customers. We're working toward basically getting a prototype product where we can demonstrate the full value, she says. For now, the value comes in the form of tremendous operational cost savings. The startup's technology is cheaper than what is a typical industrial wastewater operation deploys today, which is why potential customers, including a mining operation in Australia, are talking to NALA. But Meacham is thinking bigger than just industrial customers saving cash. Her larger vision is treating wastewater in a cost-effective way that ensures everyone everywhere has access to safe water. There's a lot of talk about solving water challenges with seawater, but the amount of energy and cost that go into desalinization are steep. The membranes NALA develops are suited for those kinds of applications because they can tolerate disinfectants, chemicals that destroy some other membranes used for cleaning water. Specifically, they tolerate chlorine. Daniel McCurry, assistant professor with the Astani Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Southern California, isn't familiar with NALA, but is familiar with the use of membranes in cleaning wastewater through reverse osmosis. McCurry said if NALA really has cracked the code on a chlorine-tolerant solution, the market potential could be huge. Founder, successful startups target early adopters. Why find customers when you can find early adopters? That's the take of Lauren McCullough, an entrepreneurial activist and founder of two startups currently operating in the Triangle. Too often, she said, entrepreneurs look at who they could serve instead of who they should serve. Instead of running a giant ad campaign, founders need to be more creative about how they target their first 10 customers, she said. At Trommel, the Chapel Hill startup she co-founded that aims to help automotive aftermarket part sellers by sifting out useful insights from their own data, she tailored her strategy toward firms with the biggest problems. She asked herself, who is the ideal customer? A seller experiencing a lot of problems relating to their data. To find them, she tried to put herself in their heads. I tried to say, if someone was experiencing those types of problems, who would they be going to? Those sellers were complaining to service providers. Those who ran their automation software provided their product catalogs and distributed their parts. So that gave Trommel a place to start. Her advice is to tailor your early customer acquisition efforts to find the people with the most need. And finally, airline execs expect new normal season. Macroeconomics are impacting airlines flying out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Scott Kirby, CEO at United Airlines, which accounted for more than 11% of passengers boarding RDU jets in 2022, said, "It seems clear that the macro risks are higher to date than they were even a few months ago, as demonstrated by the banking scare of Silicon Valley Bank." Kirby said United Airlines experienced an immediate drop in terms of business demand that lasted for 2 weeks, but has since recovered. American Airlines CEO Rob Isom said there's still tremendous demand for air travel. "We have been through, from an airline perspective, the largest recession that we could have ever imagined," he said. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page, written by Evan Hoopfer. 140-acre plan aims to populate Creedmoor. Development offers up to 600 new homes in fast-growing city. A residential subdivision proposing hundreds of new homes is in the works in Granville County. During its April 13 meeting, the Creedmoor Planning Board considered a new subdivision called Yorkshire that would encompass 140 acres. The land sits just south of Sam Moss Hayes Road and east of U.S. Highway 15. Plans are in preliminary stages for Yorkshire, and few details are available. Subdivisions usually make their way through the Planning Board before being taken up by the Board of Commissioners for a rezoning approval or denial. Yorkshire would be built out in multiple phases according to a master plan submitted to the city. Each phase will contain approximately 150 lots homes per phase, the development team says in the application, adding the project will have three or four phases. Brian Richards of Urban Design Partners submitted the application and says the development will contain about 450 new single-family homes and townhomes. The project is being developed by LGI Homes of Texas, one of the largest home builders in the country. LGI is active in the Triangle. It has communities in Raleigh, Sanford, Holly Springs, Zebulon, and Youngsville. According to its website, it closed on 343 homes in the Triangle in 2021, according to Triangle Business Journal Research, with an average sales price of $295,322. Creedmoor is home to 5,000 people and sits just off Interstate 85 in Granville County. It sits about 20 minutes northeast of downtown Durham and 30 minutes north of Raleigh. VinFast ships more vehicles to North America. VinFast has sent its second batch of vehicles to North America. The Vietnamese automaker, which recently pushed back the opening of its 7,500-person factory in Chatham County, said on April 17 that the Silver Queen cargo ship has left the port in Haiphong, Vietnam, and will spend 20 days at sea before delivering 1,098 vehicles to the U.S. and then another 781 to Canada. The total shipment, consisting of 1,879 vehicles, is made up of VF8s, the company's five-seater SUV, starting at $49,000. These vehicles do not qualify for the $7,500 federal tax credit U.S. tax filers could get for buying an electric vehicle. The provision, which was included in the Inflation Reduction Act passed in August 2022, only applies to vehicles manufactured in the U.S. And finally, Health Clinic Eyes expansion into Sanford. Goshen Medical Clinic is looking to open a new center at 2807 South Horner Boulevard in Sanford. The company is a nonprofit that includes medical services through government funding to low-income and non-insured patients, says Tiffany Ehrenfried, the finance director for the company. This would be another location that we would have for a safety net for people who probably can't afford care any other way, Ehrenfried says. Goshen Medical Center purchased the property for $1.65 million in June 2022, according to Lee County Property Records. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Brumette. Car Space Raleigh charts luxury course. New co-working space mixes exotic cars, high-end amenities. Car Space, a co-working, social, and event space for car enthusiasts, is opening this summer. The concept is located at 5200 Greens Dairy Road, off Spring Forest Road and next to East Millbrook Middle School. The company was founded by three Triangle locals, one with a background in the automotive industry and two former startup founders. The 20,000-square-foot space just east of Capitol Boulevard will have amenities that include a full-service cocktail bar, a cigar lounge, and golfing and racing simulators. Car Space is leasing an existing flex building and has put about $3.5 million into the build-out, co-founder and CEO Dave Yount says. We're not doing anything low-end. It's really meant to be upscale, Yount says, but also an attainable community. We don't want to present ourselves as elitist. The private club will offer social memberships and co-working memberships. When at full capacity, Car Space is expected to be a 700 or 800 member club, Yount says. The club is currently accepting memberships, and so far more than 100 members have signed up. Car Space is on pace to be profitable on its first day open, Yount says. For its first year in business, the company expects revenue to fall between $2.2 and $2.5 million. So far, Car Space has been self-funded thanks to a few successful exits that the founders have been a part of in the past, Yount says. The company is in the process of closing a $1.5 million investment round from a West Coast investor, he adds. Car Space is already eyeing expansions into Charlotte and Charleston. Yount, a military veteran, has a history of working in the startup space, including co-founding Paper Street. Anthony Yu, CarSpace co-founder and chief revenue officer, founded Summit Express Medical Supply. The medical distribution company was acquired by a private equity-backed firm in 2021. CarSpace's other founder and COO, Jonathan Fifield, previously served in manager positions at Hendrick Automotive and Deacon Jones. The exotic car gallery inside CarSpace will have between 11 and 20 cars on display at all times, with large windows providing a view of the cars from the office space. New Marriott brand hotel in the works. Site plans have been filed with the town for a new AC hotel by Marriott in Cary. CN Hotels, a hospitality development group out of High Point, is behind the project. Filings show a seven-story building with 144 rooms located at 4917 NC 55. The plans are currently under review with the town. The hotel is planned for a 3.83-acre lot across from Parkside Town Commons. Renderings included in the filing depict the building with a curved shape. The plans show a lobby bar, a kitchen and dining area, a market, a media salon, and a fitness room on the first floor. The hotel would also include a 2,755-square-foot patio and gathering space. A surface lot is set to hold 144 parking spaces. CN Hotels purchased the lot for $2.3 million in July 2021. The company currently has 23 hotels in its portfolio and several more under construction. And finally, boutique to open in former Stein Mart. Painted Tree, a store concept showcasing local small businesses, is taking over the former Stein Mart space at Stonehenge Market in Raleigh. The Arkansas-based company will fill a 34,000-square-foot space. Painted Tree stores allow customers to shop from dozens of vendors selling decor, gifts, clothing, and accessories. The Raleigh store will be the company's fourth in North Carolina. It will have around 250 spots for retailers to rent, and about 90% of the spaces are already reserved. The company is hoping to open by mid to late summer. Painted Tree opened its Cary location in 2021. It's also in a former Stein Mart space. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Education page, written by Zach Ezone. Duke Health makes major exec changes. Duke Regional COO, CFO, and CNO out. As health systems throughout the country grapple with financial challenges tied to workforce shortages and rising costs, Duke University Health System is making changes at one of its hospitals. Three executives at Duke Regional Hospital in Durham have stepped down following a review of the hospital's performance. The executives include the hospital's former Chief Financial Officer, Jonathan Hoy, Chief Nursing Officer, Vicki Orto, and Chief Operating Officer, Mitch Babb. In a statement shared with Triangle Business Journal, Dr. Craig Albanese, CEO of Duke University Health System, said he determined that changes were necessary after a review of the hospital's performance. After a thorough assessment of Duke Regional Hospital's performance over the past year, I have determined the need for transformation, which requires making several leadership changes in order to best position our hospital to fulfill its mission of caring for our patients and community for the long term, Albanese said. Albanese, who was appointed to his position in February, didn't say whether this assessment of the hospital's performance related to its finances, but the changes come as health systems throughout the U.S., including Duke, face significant financial challenges. The consulting firm Kaufman Hall released a report last fall on behalf of the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, that projected anywhere from 53% to 68% of hospitals would end 2022 with negative operating margins. At least two health systems in the Triangle area ended their 2022 fiscal years with operating losses. Duke Health recorded an operating loss of $151.4 million, according to Fitch Ratings. And ECU Health ended its previous fiscal year on September 30 with a $46 million loss. In response, the health system announced in January its plans to close several regional clinics and an inpatient behavioral health unit. Much of the widespread operational challenges have been tied to labor and staffing issues that were exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. In its report, Kaufman Hall projected hospital labor and non-labor expenses to increase $86 billion and $49 billion, respectively, compared to 2021. The leadership page on Duke Regional Hospital's website lists Kristen Merritt as the facility's chief nursing officer. North Carolina Community College System appoints new president. The North Carolina Community College System has a new president. The State Board of Community Colleges on August 21 voted to appoint Jeff Cox to lead the statewide system of 58 colleges. The appointment marks the conclusion of a nearly year-long search following the abrupt resignation of the system's former president, Thomas Stith. Cox currently serves as the president of Wilkes Community College in Wilkesboro, a position he's held since 2014. He also previously served as the superintendent of Allegheny County Schools for nearly a decade. The appointment brings to an end a process that began last July following the resignation of former President Stith. Shortly after, the system appointed William Craver as interim president and began its search for a permanent replacement. Stith's departure last year continued a trend of constant change in the system's top position. Stith stepped into the role in January 2021 and succeeded Craver, who previously filled the role on an interim basis after Peter Hans left to become president of the UNC system. And finally, Cary Biopharma laying off CEO, others. A biopharmaceutical company based in Cary is laying off more than a dozen employees in Wake County as its parent company completes a broader restructuring. A representative of Enzyvant Therapeutics informed state officials on April 20 that the company will cut 15 employees, including some executive positions, by the end of June. The notice states that the layoffs are the result of the integration of Enzyvant and a number of its affiliates into one new company. Enzyvent's parent company, Sumitomo Pharma Company, a large pharmaceutical company based in Japan, unveiled this integration process in early April. And our last reporter page is written by Kaylee Thompson on real estate. Loden maps new plan for Old Cary Mall, South Hills Mall, to be transformed with hotel sports complex. Developers are looking to revitalize Cary's oldest mall with hundreds of residences, office, retail, and lab space, hotels, and a large sports complex that's been pushed by town leaders for years. Raleigh-based Loden Properties and Chicago firm North Pond Partners are partnering to transform the South Hills Mall on Buck Jones Road in Cary. The companies have applied for a rezoning from general commercial to mixed-use preliminary development plan to allow for a high-density mixed-use development. The preliminary site plans say there will be up to 1,775 multifamily units, up to 935,000 square feet of office and public institution space, up to 235,000 square feet of research lab space, up to 550,000 square feet of retail space, up to 350 hotel rooms, and 500,000 square feet of sports and recreational space. Loden and North Pond acquired the 322,000 square foot mall in November 2021 for $38.4 million. It was almost completely occupied when the companies bought it, and according to Triangle Business Journal's space data, it was 100% occupied as of the first quarter of 2023. Henry Ward, a partner at Loden Properties, said the project is going to cost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of 10 to 15 years. He said the developers haven't acquired financing or funding yet, as the project is in the early stages. The companies expect to start horizontal site work in 2024, with some of the first phase openings in late 2027, early 2028. Current tenants, including a Roses store and Northern Tool and Equipment at the mall, have the guarantee of their lease. Ward said the companies will work with current retailers and honor existing leases. Anchoring the South Hills community will be the 500,000 square foot sports complex. The town of Cary will build and manage the complex, which has been in the works for years, but now has a site to move forward with its plan. Sorry, Raleigh home buyers, these new townhomes are now for rent. What would have been for sale townhomes near Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh will now be for rent as the partially developed community has changed ownership. M&I Homes of Ohio was the initial developer behind Altair, an 88-unit townhome community off Blue Ridge Road, and had plans to sell the 2- and 3-bedroom homes in the high 300,000s. But on March 29, M&I Homes sold all of the lots, including the 17 already finished homes, to a joint venture between PCCP, a New York-based finance and investment management firm, and Abode Communities, a build-to-rent company under Edgewater Ventures of Raleigh, according to Wake County deed records. The two companies paid $7.66 million for the 14 acres and 17 finished homes at 3709 Nova Star Lane. And Ammons signs on for Wake County project. A major residential project in northern Wake County has a new developer after a major home builder backed out. The newly named Pierce Farm, originally called Tom's Creek, will be developed by Raleigh developer Ammons Development Group. The company submitted an updated rezoning request and concept plan at the end of March with the town of Rollsville after Toll Brothers left the project. The project will now include 560 lots on 224 acres west of downtown Rollsville. There will be 91 acres of open space and 22.7 acres of active open space. Project manager Drew Ammon said no home builder has been selected and the company hasn't started talks with home builders yet. With how early in the process Ammons Development Group is, there is no estimated cost or timeline. Planning Director Meredith Gruber said the Town of Rollsville Planning Board recommended approval of the rezoning with a vote of 4-1. The project will go before the Town Board of Commissioners on May 2nd. The rezoning, if approved, would allow 2.7 units per acre. And Raleigh, asking rates rise. Direct asking rental rates continued to climb in Q1 as rates rose to 30 $1.28 per square foot, a 4.4% increase year over year. Class A rental rates also increased 3.5% year over year to $31.59 per square foot, according to Cushman Wakefield's first quarter office market report. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by editor-in-chief Sugata Mukherjee. The headline, Office Space Glut to create Massive Opportunity. Ever since I moved to Raleigh some 20-plus years ago, I've never seen numbers like these. In the Triangle market, we have a 14% vacancy in office space, and another 7% of space is up for sublease. In total, that amounts to more than 12 million square feet of available office space, according to the numbers about to be released through our quarterly space publication next week. To put that in perspective, San Francisco is among the worst in the nation. The office market there closed the first quarter with an overall vacancy rate of 29.4%, net absorption of minus 1.6 million square feet, and an overall average asking rate of $75.17 per square foot. Yeah, pretty bad. The average U.S. office market vacancy during the first quarter was just under 13%. But if you look deeper into the numbers, it actually presents an opportunity for investors, not necessarily real estate investors, but investors in general. Let me explain. A recent report from KBW Research notes that U.S. banks' loan portfolio accounts for a median of about 38% of all commercial mortgages. Keep that number in mind. Now let's look at the other big investment sector that historically has pounced on real estate investment, pension plans. According to Preqin, spelled P-R-E-Q-I-N, North American public pension funds hold about 9% of their assets in real estate. For North Carolina, the $110 billion pension fund, the exposure to real estate is about 8.2%. So essentially, trillions of dollars are tied to real estate in our economy. If one is to believe that the office space glut is real this time because previous assaults on commercial real estate lacked one of the biggest hindrances to growth in office space, e-commerce and remote work, then the investment community will pivot in parking their dollars elsewhere. Where will the money go then? In equities, in bonds, in non-real estate mutuals, in products and services delivered through artificial intelligence systems? We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions, up for grabs for alternative investments. Now remember, every sector of real estate is not struggling. For example, if e-commerce is going to keep on growing, we will need more warehouses across the country. Retailers, for example, will need the ability to deliver goods within hours, not days. In areas that are growing in terms of population and jobs, more apartments will be needed. And with people comes the need for retail as well. So not all real estate is going to struggle. Almost 2 years ago, I wrote a column on this page talking about how office buildings can reinvent themselves into apartments. Certainly, there have been many instances of buildings in larger cities, such as New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, that today have people living in them rather than working there. But it is also clear that the office-to-home transformation is easier on buildings that were built 100 years ago, with operable windows. Today's office buildings have a lot of glass, but seldom any windows. You need windows and circulation of open air for safety reasons, so while office-to-housing holds promise, it simply is not the answer for the millions and millions of empty square feet out there. There are going to be billions of dollars that will move away from real estate in the next few months. For instance, if the North Carolina Pension Fund decided to cut just 2% from its 8.2% exposure, that amounts to more than $2 billion. Where will that money be reallocated? You get my point. There could be a tsunami of new money coming into various securities and equities. And now we'll read some of the big number sections that are sprinkled throughout the Triangle Business Journal. The first big number, $26.8 million. Even in a tight fundraising environment, entrepreneurs are closing deals. Over the past few days, two startups have closed blockbuster rounds. Relay, the Raleigh-based Bandwidth spinoff, which recently sold its Republic Wireless assets to Dish, announced this week that it had closed on $13 million. The company is led by CEO Chris Chuang. And Levitate, the Raleigh SaaS startup, that's SaaS, Software as a Service startup, announced this week it had raised nearly $13.8 million. The company is led by serial entrepreneur Jesse Lipsum, previously of ShareFile, which sold to Citrix. And our next number is 96, the number of townhomes being planned in a new housing development called Matthew Mill Pond in Anger, one of the hottest small towns in the Greater Triangle. And 360, that's how many Bed Bath & Beyond stores are set to close now that the company has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, meaning the company's entire brick-and-mortar portfolio. The Triangle has four locations of the national retail chain left, a Raleigh store already closed in February. Our next big number is $450 million. That's the size of a financing agreement BioCryst Pharmaceuticals has landed with the New York-based life sciences investor Pharmakon Advisors. And our last big number is 105. That's how many acres Fujifilm Corporation acquired along Davis Drive and Research Triangle Park in two separate deals totaling $16.72 million, according to Wake County deed records. And now we'll read the He Said It and She Said It sections sprinkled throughout the Triangle Business Journal. The first quote is from Michelle Baker Sanders, NC Commerce Secretary, after the North Carolina Rural Infrastructure Authority approved nine grant requests to local governments totaling $2.2 million. These communities will receive greatly needed infrastructure and building improvements to create more jobs and future investments to foster greater economic prosperity in all corners of the state. And we have Doug Worf, president of MDO Holdings, on the firm's newest concept opening in Cary, Rosecombe Beer Garden, open beside BB's Crispy Chicken, which the firm opened with Ashley Christensen inside Parkside Town Commons. I think it's neat to bring something with a local feel and a lot of local beers on tap to that area. And our last quote is from Scott Rawls, president of Wake Technical Community College, on the college recently completing numerous land deals to facilitate large capital projects like the purchase of 34 acres near U.S. Highway 1 and NC Highway 55 in Apex for the college's Western Wake campus. The deals unlock what we needed to do right now for jobs, but prepare us long term for the further growth that's happening. And in our final seconds, we'll leave you with the Business Pulse survey. The question: should North Carolina legalize online sports betting? Total number of responses, 196. 75% say yes, while 25% say no. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. And if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.